Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, Executive VP of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for Frank Gaffney. And we have the pleasure this first segment of talking with Dr. Michael Rubin, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School, and a veteran of numerous positions in Iraq during the period where we were fighting for the freedom of the Iraqi people from the tyrant Saddam Hussein. Michael, that I think people like to argue about whether or not it was a good idea to topple Saddam now. But let's set that aside. A decision was made, and in the end, a government, a peaceful democratic government in Iraq, was stood up with membership from all three of the major ethnic groups. The Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds all had a seat at the table. What went wrong?
Well, first of all, Jim, I think people also need to remember, as you're talking about, did we bring this on ourselves, to put it bluntly, by toppling Saddam, that if Saddam were alive today, he'd be 80 years old, and that the al-Qaeda in Iraq started its attacks assassinating U.S. diplomat Lawrence Foley before the war even began. So I honestly think we would be in the same place today whether or not we had toppled Saddam Hussein. Putting that aside, what went wrong? You know, I think we all two things. Number one, the United States and diplomats are obsessed with two things. One of them is creating an even playing field, and the second is democracy. Now, with regard to the even playing field, you've got a situation about, well, if we're providing an even playing field, but everyone else is picking their favorites, then anyone who makes the mistake of allying with the United States is actually at a disadvantage. When it comes to democracy, I think democracy is a noble goal. However, there's democracy in the process and democracy as a result. And too often, by emphasizing democracy in the process, what we get is anything but democracy in the result. Take, for instance, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey.
Now, he is part of the problem now, I would say, in Iraq and Syria as much as anything else. Let's jump then from where we were, and let's talk about who's in lead roles now. It's certainly not the United States. It is Iran, who has a major control over the Iraqi government and also over the Shia militias that are doing the bulk of the fighting against ISIS. It is Russia, who has successfully propped up their puppet Assad and now is bombing pretty much whoever they want with the non-existent ceasefire. And you've got Turkey, who we made a deal with for Incirlik and kind of turned them loose to do whatever they wanted against the Kurds, who are an issue for them on their border with the Kurdish desire for their own nation state. So we've got three other powers who, in my opinion, seem to have more influence than we do. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, I think it is an accurate assessment. We are still too obsessed with this notion of grievance-causing problems. People, for example, blame former Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for the rise of the Islamic State. But if that's the case, what explains the rise of the Islamic State in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula or in Libya, where you don't have Shiite-Sunni tensions? There's something else going on here, and we look everywhere but at the obvious. Now, when it comes to the Islamic State, it's become fashionable, especially as we pass the 15th anniversary of 9/11, to blame the Saudis for all radicalization. And the Saudis have been responsible, by and large, historically. But in recent years, the two most problematic states have been Turkey and Qatar. If we were going to look at this objectively, they should both be considered state sponsors of terror, but we keep allowing diplomacy to get in the way of reality, and therefore we're not recognizing that. At the same time, Secretary of State John Kerry is obsessed with diplomacy as how to get to yes is how to achieve a win-win situation. He doesn't seem to understand that both the Islamic Republic of Iran and Russia look at diplomacy as a zero-sum game. For them to win, the United States needs to lose. That's their only goal. And the fact that we keep making concessions for the sake of ameliorating tensions, Kerry is oblivious to the fact that our enemies are just pocketing those concessions for their advantage. We see this most recently with regard to Russia. Even the Iranians can't believe that the relationship between Iran and Russia has grown so tight that Russia is running bombing missions from Iran, and the world has turned upside down, and the only person that's not willing to recognize it, the only people who aren't willing to recognize it, are President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry.
Two people who I would not allow to negotiate a deal for a lemonade stand in my neighborhood. Let's look then at any potential way out of this. Right now, as we just discussed, the Russians, Iranians, and Turks are ascendant. But at some level, the U.S. still has an ability to influence things. We are still the biggest dog. You know, the rest of these folks don't really have the capabilities we do and can't operate without at least our consent and, in many cases, support. What can we do to topple the black flag? And then is it possible to build something out of what is now a two-state mess in Iraq and Syria?
Well, you know, I'm grasping at straws here, Jim, but the two positive trends. Number one would be the rise of the Kurds in Syria. They may be affiliated with the PKK, but that's not our fight. They're moderate. They're secular. They're not killing Americans. We should be supporting them. The second is in southern Iraq, a place where I spend a lot of time, the Shiites are starting to turn on the Iranians. Now, the problem with our policy is by casting all Shiites as Iranian puppets, we're creating self-fulfilling prophecy rather than recognizing that the key to defeating Iran is to split the Shiites and to co-opt them away from Iran. That's going to take policy with a scalpel rather than policy with a knife. Now, we have other opportunities here, of course. I think we got to play hardball with Turkey. I think they should be a state sponsor of terror. And if they don't want to be a state sponsor of terror, then they should change their behavior. We have F-16s based in Jordan. We have the opportunity for a no-fly zone. We should not be cooperating with Russia. And if we're afraid of conflict with Russia, you know, we shouldn't always be deferring. The Russians, the morale within the Russian military at this point, and people who have talked to Russians serving in Syria, they don't know what the heck they're doing. I mean, we're a far superior military, and we should show it. That doesn't mean we should precipitate a war with Russia, but unless you're willing to draw a red line and mean it, we're going to get played again and again and again. We need to recognize that our strategy can't be dependent on just Syria and Iraq and freeing them. That's like having a game of chess, but only looking at two squares on the board, because the Islamic State is now a worldwide phenomena. We've got to be willing to talk about the problem of radical Islamism and recognize that the issue is a battle within religious interpretation. We can't pretend that religion has nothing to do with it. When Secretary of State John Kerry says the Islamic State is neither Islamic nor a state, well, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has a PhD in theology. I don't know what the heck Kerry's credential is.
Much less than that. Okay, well, I have an idea that, although numerous people have told me it's impossible, I don't see why we don't partition. We've got the Kurds in, whether it would be Iraqi Kurdistan or Greater Kurdistan, across Iran, Syria, and parts of Turkey. We've got the Sunni, who, although they may not have oil and may have difficulty standing up a state absent that revenue, but they certainly have very little in common with the folks they've been sharing a country with, the Shia in Iraq. And then, as you said, maybe the Iraqis, who are the Shia central government, can form a minor republic and then maybe an Alawite, you know, and minority enclave on the coast. Is there any chance that could work?
Well, you know, I think the future of Syria is a future of cantons, where you have an Alawi statelet, you have the Kurdish autonomy, you have a loose central government that holds it all together. Within Iraq, I oppose the partition, and the reason is this. If you have a Sunni stan, it's just going to formalize al-Qaeda's presence there or the Islamic State's presence. The one thing the Islamic State doesn't have, doesn't control, is a capital, so we don't want to give them one. The Kurds make Machiavelli look like Neville Chamberlain. The Kurds have been in deep with the Islamic State when they thought it was in their interest to use the Islamic State to weaken the central government. That's a fire that got out of control. And when it comes to the Shiites, the fact of the matter is the fact that there are so many non-Shiites in Iraq make it a little bit harder for Iran to gobble up Iraq. So I'm afraid that the partition wouldn't solve the policy issues that are of most concern to the United States and actually might exacerbate them.
Well, if it was easy, somebody would have already done it. Thank you so much for your insight and commentary.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Up next after the break, we will continue to discuss the ongoing mess in Mesopotamia. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, Executive VP of the Center for Security Policy, and I want to continue this discussion about the ongoing mess in Mesopotamia. We won the war in Iraq. In 2006 to 2008, when President Bush ordered the surge to reinforce our efforts and made a conscious decision to prosecute this war to a successful finish, he did it. We did it. The troops did it. The Iraqis did it. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was defeated. The government of Iraq was spun up as a federal republic. The Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shia all came to the table. They formed a government, and they began the difficult process of building a country out of the ashes of war. Then along came President Barack Obama and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And in their infinite wisdom, they decided that perhaps all that effort really wasn't worth it. Now, Hillary voted for the war as a senator. Obama, when he became president, decided that his legacy was going to be ending wars. So he decided he would end the war in Iraq. Now, there's one significant problem with that concept. You can't end wars. You either win them or you lose them. And in this case, the war itself had been won. We were in the position where all we needed to do was transition out of our main combat role to a supporting role where we kept the promises that were made to the different groups that formed the new Iraq. That was the Shia, who were the main folks running the government of Baghdad and the majority of the population, the Sunni, who lived in Al-Anbar province and who had Al-Qaeda in Iraq living among them and joined us to defeat them, and the Kurds, who for all intents and purposes had formed their own autonomous region and basically just needed us to make sure the Iraqi government took care of them. Well, Obama and Clinton decided that wasn't important enough, and they cut and ran. Hence the debacle we currently have. In Iraq and Syria, where the Islamic State planted the black flag, declared a caliphate, and became a rallying point for jihadists all around the world. It didn't have to be that way. It was bad decisions that guaranteed it. Now, when in 2008 we were at the point where Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been defeated, the Iraqi government had been stood up with all three of the major ethnic groups, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, at the table, and the United States there as guarantor, as midwife of democracy. That was a potential for success. That actually had the possibility that those groups could work together. Now, they didn't want to, but we were there with both a carrot and a stick to make sure they did that. Well, when President Obama and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, decided that was not what they wanted, they wanted to end U.S. combat operations, they wanted to bring the troops home, they opened the door for the inevitable outcome, which create a vacuum. The vacuum will be filled. Who filled it? We knew who was going to fill it. Anybody with an above room temperature IQ knew who was going to fill it. The Iranians, to start with, who are not our friends, became the primary force behind the Shia-dominated Baghdad government. The Iranians are Shia, the majority of the population is Shia, and as soon as the U.S. stopped being the major force in the region, as soon as we tried to lead from behind, they took over and they pushed the Baghdad government back where it wanted to be anyhow, which was not taking care of the other groups. We made major promises to the Sunni tribal leaders and the Sunni populace in Al-Anbar province when we did the surge in 2006 to 2007. We sent troops in there and we told them, if you work with us, if you help us destroy al-Qaeda in Iraq, we will make sure that the Baghdad government, which consists largely of Shia who are not big fans of you, will make sure they take care of you. We'll make sure they share aid, they share oil revenues, they give you money for construction projects, all the things that are required for a fair and equitable democracy. Well, they believed us, the fools. And the problem is, we did not follow up on that. We cut and ran. We packed up, we left, we lost influence, and guess what? The central government in Baghdad, influenced and largely controlled by Iran, did nothing to help the Sunni tribes. Consequently, that gave a rationale and breathing space for ISIS to form and to flourish. Now, it's one thing to say that Obama was the founder, but he was certainly the enabler. He and Hillary Clinton, their policy of leaving the Sunni tribes with no help, with no support, gave ISIS what they needed, gave them the oxygen, gave them the space, gave them the opportunity. Now we're in a situation where they have spread across large swaths of Syria, across large swaths of Iraq, and the only people right now fighting them and doing a particularly good job of killing them is the Shia militias backed by Iran. Now, let's harken back to those glory days of the surge. The other group we were fighting besides al-Qaeda in Iraq was these same Shia militias. They're savages. And right now, all the gains you hear President Obama talking about when he says we're pushing ISIS out, we're winning the war on the ground, well, to some extent, that's true. We're pushing ISIS out of some of the territory they controlled, and it's those Shia militias using U.S. weapons, U.S. tanks, U.S. armored vehicles, all of these things that are doing that work. And in the process, they are slaughtering thousands of Sunni civilians because they hate them. There is a centuries-long Shia-Sunni internal civil war over the succession of Muhammad within Islam. Well, guess what? Those two groups hate each other, and because of that, as these Shia militias are trying to clear ISIS out, they're also clearing out every living, breathing person in that area. And then once they've killed, raped, tortured, and slaughtered the people, they're looting the areas. So if this is in some way, shape, or form a victory against ISIS, it is a humanitarian nightmare and a war crime we are aiding and abetting against the Sunni population of al-Anbar. And there's no way that those Shia militias and the Shia-dominated government are going to be able to govern those areas, having just slaughtered most of the adult populace. This is a nightmare scenario, and it leads to more Iranian control. It leads to a situation where the U.S. has no influence. In addition to empowering the Iranians, President Obama's weakness led to Russia moving in. So we've got Russia dominating play in Syria. We've got Iran dominating play and creating slaughter in the Sunni regions of Iraq. Russia doing the same in the Sunni regions of Syria. And now we've even got Turkey moving in and slaughtering Kurds. So essentially, President Obama's feckless decision not to follow through on the victories that were won has led to death and destruction by three bad actors, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and no chance for any kind of a stable situation to come out of this. It's one of the worst strategic military decisions made in my lifetime. Thanks, Obama. This is Jim Hansen, and we'll be back with more Secure Freedom Radio, talking with Fred Flights about Ed Snowden, traitor.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People people from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The disease known in official circles as willful blindness about the nature of the threat we are facing from Islamic supremacists is reaching epidemic proportions. In the wake of last weekend's attacks, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, President Obama, and others have gone to considerable lengths to downplay the jihadist nature of the perpetrators and the ideology animating their violence. The Wall Street Journal yesterday reported on the difficulty experts are having figuring out the Islamists' motivation, and the U.S. Senate may shortly institutionalize such muddle-headedness by creating an Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security to pay so-called Muslim community partners to help counter violent extremism. Fortunately, Representative Scott Perry will hold a hearing in the House of Representatives today aimed at assessing the utter failure of this approach and how the willful blindness it epitomizes is putting Americans at needless and growing risk. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're going to continue doing Secure Freedom Radio, joined this segment by Fred Fleitz, who is our own Senior VP for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, a former CIA analyst, Chief of Staff for Ambassador John Bolton, and a staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. And Fred, you wrote an amazing, as always, piece that pointed out the folly behind what I'm stunned to say is an effort to get Edward Snowden pardoned. Now, I don't know why in the world we would want to do that, but why don't you go ahead and lay out the case for the listeners as to why Ed Snowden is a traitor and a fraud?
Jim, it's good to be here. I also might want to add that I took one for the team and went to see Oliver Stone's absolutely terrible movie about Snowden this week, and maybe we can get into that. Well, there's this belief that Snowden is a hero because he revealed information that told the American people about NSA programs that were violating their rights and weren't being monitored by the U.S. government. The fact is, these programs are legal. They were carefully monitored by the courts and the Intelligence Oversight Committees, and I know this because I was a staff in the House Intelligence Committee for 5 years. But even if he started a meaningful debate, by saying this guy should be pardoned for doing that is basically saying that you agree with the principle that the end justifies the means, and to vindicate someone who took the law into his own hands. You know, we found out there were some minor problems with these programs, and that could have been dealt with through the committee system if Snowden had went to a member of the intelligence committees of the Justice Department, but he didn't. He leaked enormous amounts of classified information that aided and abetted Al-Qaeda. That's why former CIA Director Woolsey has called for Snowden to be executed. He gave crucial intelligence on the black intelligence budget that I'm sure the Chinese and Russians have made great use of in planning their intelligence programs. He harmed our country severely, and the idea to pardon him is frankly a joke.
So he, in order to attempt to kill a fly that was buzzing around bothering him in his car, he drove it off a bridge and did the entire country a huge amount of damage. And as you mentioned, some of those things have quite likely gotten people killed. It's not like he had to actually release a list of agents who were working covertly to cause us problems and to cause issues in some of the countries where we're operating that were going to get people friendly to us put in jail, tortured, and like I said, potentially killed.
That's exactly right. He did enormous damage. And the Washington Post came out this week and said in an editorial he should not be pardoned. And the reason is the Post realizes that he leaked far more information than necessary to make whatever point he was trying to make about secrecy. Jim, he leaked so much material that some of it was too sensitive for the Post to publish. Now, here's an intelligence officer who dumped everything but the kitchen sink on journalists and said to journalists, you guys decide what's too dangerous to print. I mean, what kind of idiot is this? This isn't a real whistleblower. This is the House Intelligence Committee put out a bipartisan unanimous report saying he is basically a congenital liar, a disgruntled employee, and not a whistleblower.
Is there any chance that Obama loses his mind? Well, let me rephrase that. Is there any chance that Obama actually pardons this guy?
You know, you and I have been pretty harsh on the president, but let me tell you, he is doing the right thing in standing by his guns and not pardoning Snowden. And I'm hopeful he'll continue to do that. And I think this bipartisan House Intelligence Committee report indicates his position. Also, with the Washington Post saying, don't pardon him. And, of course, the Post published a lot of his leaks. I'm very hopeful that the president will do the right thing and not pardon this traitor. And I'm thinking that there's a possibility that if our relations improve with Snowden, that he might be extradited and finally put on trial.
I would be willing to trade for him so he could go make small rocks out of big rocks at Leavenworth as he deserves. I don't know how high on the hog he's living in Russia, but certainly higher than a man who broke that many laws and damaged our national security that much deserves. Fred, all right, tell us about the movie. How horrifyingly bad was it? Oliver Stone, that's a good start for bad, but give us the skinny.
It's just incredibly misleading. It betrays him as a hero from start to beginning. And it has all kinds of things that just didn't happen. For example, he was fired by the CIA for trying to access classified information when he was assigned to Geneva that he didn't want. In the movie, he says that he resigned for ethical reasons over this covert operation he invented that he thought was wrong. And there's all kinds of nonsense like that, stuff that didn't happen. It portrays him as this brilliant fast-rising employee when the House Intelligence Committee report said he was a problem employee who argued all the time with management and its coworkers. And it doesn't mention something I think is very significant. To get a lot of this intelligence he leaked, he tricked his NSA colleagues into providing him with their passwords, which he used to steal information. You know what happened to them? They were all fired. So that's what this great whistleblower did. He screwed his employees so he could screw our country.
Well, Fred, I think most of us here can agree that Snowden is more a traitor and fraud, as your article points out and as your commentary here points out, than any kind of a hero. But Fred, let's shift gears now and talk about one of the areas you've focused on significantly and written a brilliant book, Obama Bomb, about the Iran nuclear debacle. Apparently, one of the folks who failed to stop this or attempt to stop in any meaningful way, House Speaker Paul Ryan, now seems to have figured out that he was not just snookered, but he was lied to, cheated, and the American public was done the same. What's his revelations that he's come to recently?
Well, he made a welcome speech this week that Congress was lied to when it voted on the nuclear agreement last September, not simply because the secret side deal about Iran inspecting itself wasn't revealed, but the fact that plane loads of cash were flown to Iran as part of this swap of Iranian prisoners to free basically Americans who were being held hostage from Iran. And there's so many aspects, other aspects of this deal that the administration withhold. He basically came forward and said, this deal is a fraud, which is something you and I have been saying for a long time. I wish he had said this earlier, but it was welcome to hear him say this so clearly.
So now we're in a situation where we know a ton of money, satchels, pallets, plane loads of cash, and payments galore, ransoms, everything was paid to the Iranians. Is there anything that can be done to salvage this deal, this debacle, once we have a new president, or are we just going to have to live with it?
Well, I think we need a new agreement that cuts off all transfers of nuclear technology to Iran and places very stiff sanctions on Iran until it stops its sponsorship of terrorism, destabilizing the Middle East, testing ballistic missiles, and threatening Israel. We can, if we put back these sanctions on nuclear technology, I think we can significantly slow the nuclear program. And we just basically have to say to the nations of the world, if you trade nuclear technology with Iran, you can't do business with the United States. I think that'll do a lot.
Now, that sounds a lot more down the path we should be, but there doesn't seem to be much will on one side of the fence for that. Is there? What do you think the American public, are they still as against this deal as they seem to be all along? I mean, this was done at the time of its implementation at something around a 25% approval rating. Does the American public still believe this thing is as bad as we know it is?
I haven't seen a late recent poll, but I think in light of these plane loads of cash, the support for this deal is very low. The majority of Congress continues to oppose it. We know Hillary Clinton will stick by the deal. Donald Trump says he'll renegotiate it. I think he should throw it out. But frankly, I'm willing to side with someone who will renegotiate it. And Trump also said he will send it to Congress for a ratification vote, which should have been done in the first place. I think that's a promising start.
Ooh, that takes so he would make it a treaty and send it there.
It is a treaty, of course. And I mean, if we have a major commitment like this, Congress should be behind it.
That's brilliant. Well, Fred Flights, our own senior VP for policy and programs at CSP, let's hope they are listening and do the things you have recommended, because the current state is a nightmare. Up next, we'll be talking with Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, it is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and we are talking now with Elaine Donnelly, founder and president of the Center for Military Readiness. She was appointed by President George H.W. Bush to the Presidential Commission on the Assignment of Women in the Armed Forces. And there seems to be quite a bit of discussion right now about some attempts to add women to the Selective Service System and make them eligible for the draft. Could you give us kind of the one over the world view of where that legislation stands, who's pushing it, and what it would actually entail?
Senator John McCain put into his version of the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, a measure calling for women to be subject to registration for selective service on the same basis as men. Not to reinstate the draft at this time, but registration. Now, a lot of people don't understand what is the purpose of selective service. It is something, it's like an insurance policy in case there is a catastrophic attack on the United States beyond the capability of the all-volunteer force. Selective service may have to be reinstituted in order to find and train and mobilize young men who can fight and who can replace what are called combat replacements. You don't have a draft or register anyone for desk jobs being in the Marine Band. Women and men also volunteer for those kinds of positions, but we're talking about combat replacements for men who are dying in battle. This is a serious issue. But Senator McCain treated it like a non-issue, as if this was just some kind of a bouquet to women. It could not be further from the truth. Not only would this measure harm young women, it would harm readiness. And this is the part that I hope the senators will think through a little bit more closer than they have so far. We know that there are physical differences between men and women. Research done by the Marine Corps since 2012 through 2015 documented physical differences in the units that are called direct ground combat, the infantry, armor, special operations, and the like. The Marines asked for exceptions to across-the-board mandates. They were overruled. Now women are serving in those units, but guess what? Very, very few have shown any interest in going into the combat arms, and among those who have, an even tinier minority have been able to come even close to competing with men in these very physically demanding jobs. Now, let's imagine we have a national emergency. We have to call up thousands of young people over the age of 18 who are registered. Why would selective service, why should it be forced to call in 50% women, 50% men, knowing that only a tiny minority of those women might be qualified, whereas most of the men would be? You would totally jam up the system. It would be the worst possible thing to do at a time of national crisis. So we're looking at this as a military readiness issue as well as a cultural issue. Do we really need to force women to fight future wars?
Now, let me ask and dig into some of the arguments for this that say the Supreme Court previously had ruled that women could not be drafted because they don't serve in the infantry. But now that they do, you know, and there are actually women company commanders in infantry units and other things like that, that objection seems to be, I guess, in jeopardy. Is that going to have to be relitigated?
Not really. Yes, that premise is no longer the case under this administration. However, even if you have a few women who are in these positions that used to be all male, that still doesn't make the case to bring in all women on the same basis as men once they reach their 18th birthday. But there's also a legal premise that people need to remember. The case you just referenced, Roster versus Goldberg, the primary issue was Congress's right to decide. It was an easy call to make because Congress had a full week's worth of hearings back in 1979 on Jimmy Carter's proposal to include women in registration for selective service. Congress, in its wisdom, after looking at the issue for a full week in the House and I think something comparable in the Senate, decided, and this is a quote from the Senate report, women, it would be administratively unworkable to include women in selective service because of the physical differences that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So even under the current circumstances, if Congress makes that case, and if the next administration makes the case, that it would be administratively unworkable and therefore harmful to include women in selective service, you can't predict a future Supreme Court decision, but chances are very strong that the Supreme Court would once again defer to the wisdom of Congress. Now, the problem is, if Congress does something stupid, the court also will defer to that stupidity, meaning including women in selective service registration. There's no excuse for this. And a lot of people, there's another misunderstanding about this. Some men are resentful of women. They're resentful of feminists. They make arguments like, well, if you wanted equality, then you can be injured and killed at the same rate that men are. This is resentment. You can call it egalitarian sexism. The polls that were done for the Presidential Commission on which I served showed that this cohort of men, resentful men, is quite large. It's significant. And we're seeing that reflected in the polls today. That also is not a good reason to impose on civilian women who aren't even aware of this issue, this burden of selective service registration. It is much even less, it's even less justifiable if you blame military women for this. Military women did not ask to go into the combat units. In fact, 92.5% of Army women said they wanted nothing to do with this. The Marine survey showed this would cause young women and men to be less likely to serve in the all-volunteer force.
Elaine, let me play devil's advocate then for a moment. You pointed out rightly that the purpose of selective service was to be able to replace large numbers of forward combat troops in a large-scale war or large-scale national emergency where we needed them in an immediate fashion. But the current military has a very large, what is called the tooth-to-tail ratio, meaning the number of support troops that are required to keep every combat troop, every infantry or special operator operating is very large. In some cases, 8 to 10 to 1. Wouldn't it be possible to adapt this in some way so that women, if they're coming in through selective service, are not going directly into those combat roles, but are filling the support roles that are equally necessary?
That's inherently unequal. In the name of equality, you would have an unequal, bifurcated system. But the implication, and I'm sure you didn't mean to imply that women don't serve in time of war, the fact is they do. Both military and civilian women always, always have stepped forward to fill those positions that are considered support role, the tail to the tooth. And there's no reason to believe they would not do so again. Again, the volunteer force has more women now than ever. They are serving with courage and commitment. They didn't ask to be forced into the combat positions. Many of them realize that for physical differences, they can serve their country better in the traditional positions they already have. I think it to imply that they would not be there and say, well, we have to coerce everyone, even if, as I said before, it jams up the system so bad that we can't even find the men who are really the best qualified to replace the combat arms. And in time of war, they are the ones who would be the place where the most acute need is. Remember that in both the Army and the Marine Corps, the largest community is the infantry. So there's no way that you could have selective service and try to impose theories of equality that do not match reality. It would harm military readiness at the worst possible time.
Elaine Donnelly, founder and president of the Center for Military Readiness. Thank you so much for bringing that insight to our program. This is Jim Hansen, and that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow to bring you more ammunition in the war for ideas.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.